China is now increasingly pushing not just its power, but its model of authoritarian state capitalism as a better, more efficient model. And China is increasingly, like Russia's been trying to do, seeking to discredit the model of liberal democracy and the universal values that lie behind the liberal international order.
From the McCourtney Institute for Democracy on the campus of Penn State University, I'm Michael Berkman.
And I'm Chris Beam.
And I'm Jenna Spinelli, and this is Democracy Works.
So, Jenna, today we have the one and only Larry Diamond.
That's right. Larry is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He is the former director of the Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law at Stanford. And as if that wasn't enough, he's the author of a new book called Ill Winds: Saving Democracy from Russian Rage, Chinese Ambition, and American Complacency. And the Chinese ambition piece of that title is what we focus our discussion on today.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this interview. We've talked at various times throughout the, the couple of years now that we've been on the air about how democracies die and threats to democracy, mostly those that come internally from within the country. I think Larry Diamond here is laying out the threats to democracy from authoritarian regimes, in particular Russia, and what I believe we'll talk about with him today, China.
I think there are a lot of echoes of what we heard from Ziblatt and Lewitsky's book, and kind of something that we've referred to a number of times, of this authoritarian playbook that we see going on in China right now, and in more extreme ways in a lot of other countries.
Well, I was looking at it a little bit differently than that, actually. I mean, I see that authoritarian playbook as what, for example, the authors of How Democracy Dies saw as happening within liberal democracies,
right,
that are threatening the democracies, including our own, which they talk about quite extensively. But I think Diamond is suggesting something different, and that is that Larry is saying that these authoritarian regimes, as they gain power, both economic and political, are themselves threats to democracy.
Absolutely.
Especially liberal democracy.
And I think our nation has been, for very good reasons, focused on the threat from Russia and the, you know, influence through social media, et cetera. But I don't know that we are sufficiently attuned to the kind of distinctive, powerful, and overwhelming strategy around China and their push for this authoritarian, anti-democratic model.
Right. Well, frankly, it's been a bit of a muddle in terms of American foreign policy towards China. Because on the one hand, the president has been pretty tough and aggressive in taking on a variety of trade issues with China. So he's recognized the threat that China poses. On the other hand, we pulled ourselves out of TPP, the Trans-Pacific
Partnership,
which was intended as a defense against China influence.
Yeah, I mean,
it
is a very
influence.
Difficult position for American corporations, because you are talking about four times the market of the United States. It's just an incredible
market for us to be.
Right, and you can't avoid it. You can't compete on a worldwide scale without being involved in China.
But I wonder sometimes if Americans have an appreciation for how, even though there is much that is similar to a market economy in China, while there is a form of capitalism in China, it's a very different kind of capitalism than we have.
Absolutely. It is.
I mean, it's a state-owned capitalism,
right,
for one thing.
Right. It's
a capitalism without liberty and freedoms.
That's exactly right. It is an authoritarian capitalism, or a state-controlled capitalism, however you want to talk about it. But yeah, I mean, the assumption was always within the United States that once China achieves middle-class economic status, once free enterprise gets a foothold, it's just going to be impossible to avoid a kind of expansion of liberty and democracy. And China has very adroitly shown that they can do both.
Yeah.
They can avoid the democracy and still achieve amazing economic growth.
Right, Diamond's book lays out, and you find in other places as well. I mean, China is an enormous surveillance state. it's just incredible the extent to which they are perfecting technology that enables them to limit freedoms.
And that was always the deal. I'm almost explicitly with the Chinese people that, you know, you are not going to get freedom or, you know, human rights, but you will get a rising standard of living. And, you know, Yasha Monk argues that for most people, economics is what drives their politics. And I'm quite confident there's a lot of people in the third world who would see that bargain and say, fine, I'll take it. If I can go from where I am now to the standard of living that's happened in China over the last 20 years, sign me up.
But you know, what we haven't really talked about is the threat that places like China pose to other democracies, both in Asia, emerging around the world, and even to the United States, especially as the U.S. under Donald Trump withdraws from world leadership,
right,
in terms of being a leading, you know, leading liberal democracy.
Well, there are a lot of well-established democracies who are far more focused on an internal domestic political struggle than they are even thinking about an external struggle, which creates an opportunity, right, that China is doing a really good job of exploiting, right? But I do think you're right. Diamond talks a lot about the culture of a democracy as being the most essential element. The way that the democracy is going to sustain itself is not simply through institutions, but through culture. And right now, especially in the United States, we have a democratic culture that is more beleaguered than it's been in decades, to say the least.
Guys, lots to unpack here. We've set the table pretty well, I think, and we'll hear more from Larry. So let's go to my interview with Larry Diamond. This is Jenna Spinelli here today with Larry Diamond. Larry, thank you for joining us on Democracy Works.
I'm delighted to be with you.
So we have wanted to talk about China on our show for a while, and we could maybe think of no better person to talk about some of the threats that China is posing to liberal democracy throughout the world, really. And it's something that you explore in your new book, Ill Wind. So we'll dive into some of those themes here and some of the tactics that China is using. But before we get to that, I think it might be helpful to set the stage of, you know, what is the vision that China is trying to sell to the rest of the world?
Well, I think it's multiple visions. One is of China's natural, inevitable, and rightful rise to a leadership role in the world, in the world's geopolitical affairs. 10, 15 years ago, this was expressed in a more benign form by former Deputy Secretary of State Robert Zoellick when he laid out a vision of the People's Republic of China becoming a responsible stakeholder in global affairs. If it were merely that, China becoming a responsible partner in addressing global problems of security, humanitarian crises, climate change, et cetera, of course, that would be a welcome development. But China is increasingly trying to become, I think, the dominant power in Asia, the dominant economic power in the world, the technological leader of the world, and the geopolitical shaper of the future direction of the world. And if it were just a normal country or even, you know, only a modestly authoritarian country like Singapore, I'm not sure this would be such cause for concern. But China is becoming again, you know, more authoritarian, even neo-totalitarian. We can talk about this with its social credit system, its intense repression of the Uyghur and other religious and cultural minorities in China, its tightening repression and concentration of power under Xi Jinping, and its domineering claims to the South China Sea and to, you know, open access and exclusive access for it in other Asian countries, buying up ports and infrastructure, and frankly, politicians as well. All of this is ominous. All of China's technological theft of intellectual property and other means of coercing the transfer of high cutting edge technology, which it claims is for purely China's commercial leadership in the world, is being plowed immediately back into the modernization and expansion at a dizzying pace of the People's Liberation Army, which is the whole military of China. So I think all of these trends have gone from being concerning to being alarming.
Yeah, and you've worked in this region for a long time. Was this something that people kind of foresaw, or when did things kind of reach that tipping point from concerning to alarming, as you just mentioned?
In the spirit of openness here, I'm not a China expert, but I have been studying Taiwan closely for 20 years, which does provide a certain window onto one of the most exposed and endangered societies in the region with respect to the People's Republic of China. And I've been engaging Hong Kong and mainland China itself. I think that there has been a gradual trend of China's rising military and commercial power, its accelerating coercion and daring, even plunder in terms of high technology, and its gradually increasing kind of bullying posture on the regional and world stage. But this really crossed a wholly different threshold with Xi Jinping's rise to power in 2012-2013 and his increasing domination and personalization and submission of the Chinese political system and society and generally the entire region to his personal will and concentrated power. So I'd say it's in the last 3 to 5 years that we're really realizing the scale and scope of this problem and the increasingly authoritarian character of the regime that lies behind it.
Right. And so as people who generally value liberal democracy, I think it's easy for us to look at this and say, well, this is terrible. Why would anyone ever buy into something like this? But why are countries in Africa or elsewhere in Asia finding what this model, what China is trying to push, appealing?
I'm not sure people find the full model appealing. So it is true, China is now increasingly pushing not just its power, but its model of authoritarian state capitalism as a better, more efficient model. And China is increasingly, like Russia has been trying to do, seeking to discredit the model of liberal democracy and the universal values that lie behind the liberal international order. That is another new element to what Xi Jinping is doing. It's much more explicit and in your face in challenging democracy itself. I think what appeals to people around the world, our public opinion data show, is China's rapid economic growth, not its suppression of religious freedom, freedom of expression, the internet, and so on. There's no way you can sell that to ordinary people as an appealing model that they want to live under themselves. But the allure is that somehow if countries can achieve China's rapid economic growth, and if China can downplay, minimize, or mask, which it is certainly trying to do, the intensely authoritarian and in the technological elements, I'd say, Orwellian aspects of its increasingly authoritarian rule, then that model can be appealing to people around the world because people want to get rich fast like China did. And so once people see the downsides of the China model, that the Chinese people have massively lost their privacy and freedom, that there is this Orwellian surveillance state that is emerging where people are constantly being monitored in their social media, monitored in their physical movements, having their DNA collected, you know, having their faces being recognized with artificial intelligence, having all of this mashed up into a, you know, cloud computing system that will produce a social credit score for the political loyalty, ultimately, of every Chinese citizen. When people around the world hear this element of the dark side of the People's Republic of China, it's not very appealing.
Right. But I mean, you mentioned that there are ways that China is trying to control that narrative, right? Or control the way that some of these things are perceived throughout the world.
Right. Well, this brings us to, I think, one of the most interesting, and yes, I do use the word alarming, elements of China's rising international profile, which is its very rapidly accelerating efforts to project sharp power, not the soft power of open and transparent persuasion to its culture and its model and its institutions, but the sharp power of disinformation, deception, coercion, bribery, and penetration of the political and civil institutions of open societies to try and shape the narrative about China, to censor any mention of the dark side of what it's doing, to censor or recast any account of its massive violation of human rights in Xinjiang province, where somewhere between 1 and 2.5 or 3 million Uyghur Muslims are now in re-education camps, which are really political concentration camps, and beginning to be dispersed around the country, where human rights lawyers have been rounded up and abused and intimidated and prevented from doing their work, where journalists and professors are increasingly under rigid monitoring and ideological control. They don't want people to know about any of this. What they want people to know is that, you know, China is a benign power in the world. It's an idealistic country trying to help people develop. They don't want the story to get out that the way they help people develop is by lending money at commercial rates to build its One Belt, One Road infrastructure. And then when countries land in debt as a result of this, even debt that can never be repaid, China rapaciously claims future supplies of oil, timber, natural resources, 99-year leases on ports and other infrastructure, and countries lose their sovereignty. China doesn't want any of this to be known. So increasingly, they are trying to use money to win over journalists, to plant stories in newspapers, to discourage any independent reporting of what they're doing. They're trying to manipulate overseas Chinese communities to become advocates for the cause. They're using the classic structures, institutional arrangements, financial arrangements, and supposed, you know, cultural ties and obligations of the United Front structure to try and get Chinese Americans, Chinese Australians, Chinese living in Europe and Africa and so on, to do the bidding of the regime. And this has very serious implications for democracy, the rule of law, transparency, and openness. Yeah. The difference between soft power and sharp power, as noted by the former Australian Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, is that China's sharp power efforts are using tactics that are covert, coercive, and corrupting. And that just can't be allowed in a democracy.
Right. Yeah, that's such a powerful line, such a great way to describe these tactics. You also talk in your book about some of the ways China is wielding its power, its influence through universities and also through philanthropic organizations. Can you talk a little bit more about what that looks like?
China uses money to try and win people over. There's no question about that. And it's not only individuals, but institutions. And so, there are some 150 Confucius Institutes in the United States now, and several hundred more around the world that have the generous support of the Chinese Ministry of Education to teach language, Chinese language, on college campuses, but at the price of having the Chinese Communist Party State's Ministry of Education appoint and guide the instructors and prepare the curriculum and so on. On many campuses, this, if not most, this seems to be relatively innocuous, but it can lead to a certain censorship of difficult topics, and it can lead the Chinese government to use this as leverage to demand that certain kinds of speakers and certain kinds of topics not appear in the campus conversation. You've got a large number of Chinese students and scholars associations on college campuses in the U.S. And these may be, and we have documented instances where they have been, not only funded by nearby Chinese consulates, but instructed to protest when people come and speak about Tibet, including the Dalai Lama, or China's human rights violations in Xinjiang province, or when speakers might question China's claims to and militarization of the South China Sea. And a lot of this has as its goal the construction of a web of financial ties, financial partnership, sympathy, and dependence, so that professors and universities will just think twice before they become too critical of China. And so they will be open to cooperation on more or less the terms of the PRC, happily receiving delegations chosen by the PRC, clipping the criticism they might offer of the People's Republic of China. Often what you have is very well-intentioned and experienced scholars knowing this is a danger, but, you know, wanting access to China, wanting to be able to get a visa to go to the country, wanting the ability to see people. And therefore, you know, if not becoming personally immersed in these questionable personal ties that, you know, have expectations of delivery, at a minimum, you know, trimming what they're saying. In essence, and some scholars have used this term to us, engaging in self-censorship so they can continue to have access to the People's Republic of China. As a result of this, and as a result of the fact that many Chinese students know that they're being monitored by their peers and others on American university campuses, knowing that the Chinese state is monitoring their social media posts and so on, knowing that if they speak up at public events, it could be reported back to China, and their scholarship could be at risk, or their parents could be in trouble. You know, freedom of expression and freedom of academic and intellectual inquiry are being constrained on U.S. college campuses, not just in China.
So the other piece of ill winds or another major theme is that in many ways, the U.S. and other Western democracies are not prepared for some of the threats that China poses. Can you just talk briefly about that, about what, you know, why we're not maybe necessarily as prepared as we ought to be to deal with the threats to democracy that are coming from China?
Well, I think some of this has come on pretty rapidly as China has emerged now with stunning speed as the world's second and nearly co-equal superpower. And I think Americans, having grown weary from the burdens of global leadership, are reluctant to come to grips with the implications of having a neo-totalitarian rival superpower trying to penetrate it, its societal institutions, those in the U.S., steal our technology, our most sensitive cutting-edge technologies, artificial intelligence, drone technology, robotics, supercomputing, and so on, and edge us out in terms of global commercial, geopolitical, and military leadership in the world. I think it's very hard for Americans to get their arms around this. And there are a lot of people who sincerely have a more benign and sympathetic view of China and think that those of us who are ringing these alarm bells now are new cold warriors. We don't want a cold war. We just want a fair, balanced, and transparent set of relations, trade relations, political relations, based on some minimal degree of respect for the international rule of law and the human rights and privacy of our own citizens, if not the citizens of the People's Republic of China as well. And I think we're really reaching a crunch point now on Hong Kong as the world wakes up to the desperation and passion and commitment of the more than 2 million people in Hong Kong who've come out at one time or another to protest for democracy and against Beijing's encroachments on the civil liberties and rule of law that have made Hong Kong a distinctive part of the Chinese firmament. I think the world is waking up to how serious the situation is.
Yeah, the world is waking up, but is that message getting through? Do you think that what's happening in Hong Kong is likely to move the needle at all?
It's moving the needle globally, of course, because China, the People's Republic of China, the Chinese Communist Party, has such an information monopoly within its borders. Most people are getting a very jaundiced and biased view within mainland China of what's happening in Hong Kong. But I think word is getting out globally. And, you know, there are a non-trivial number of professionals, students, intellectuals, and other well-informed people in the People's Republic of China who travel to Hong Kong, travel internationally, have virtual private networks that can enable them to navigate around the Chinese Great Firewall of internet censorship. And I think there is a certain slice of the Chinese population that's well aware of what's going on in Hong Kong and how sinister the Chinese Communist Party's intransigence and denial of Hong Kong's rights is and what it forebodes for the future direction of the People's Republic of China. And certainly the people of Taiwan have taken clear and vigilant note of what's been going on in Hong Kong. I think the real question now is to what extent ordinary Americans in a variety of institutions that have never found the need to worry that China might be a threat or that China might be seeking to compromise the integrity of our values and institutions. People, as I said, in local government, in state legislatures, in universities, in the mass media, in think tanks, in businesses, whether they are going to come to a sufficiently clear-eyed, knowledgeable, and resolute understanding of the rising risks of compromise coercion that are coming from relations with the Chinese Communist Party state, and insist on, educate themselves about this, acquire the necessary information to vet the relationships, join with one another to insist on common standards for these partnerships, exchanges, relationships, and so on, and refuse to be intimidated or played off one against another.
Right. Yeah, no, that, and I mean, to be able to resist the threat, for example, when a Chinese company shows up in your town with, you know, offering jobs and millions or billions of dollars, that's a hard decision to turn away from.
Laying fiber optics and so on for maybe a city in great financial need, but, you know, when Huawei lays fiber optic cables or sets up a 5G infrastructure of communications, this is not an act of charity. Huawei is an extension of the Chinese Communist Party state. It's not disclosed. It's masquerading as a private company. But I think most people who study China know this to be pure fiction. You know, if you're going to allow this kind of company to process everybody's data, what's going to happen to it? It's going to be monitored. It's going to be captured. It's going to be sent back to Chinese supercomputers. And our democratic rights of privacy as individual citizens and our national economic military security are going to be at grave risk.
Right. Larry, I know you have to go. The last thing I want to ask you about is the trade war. Amid all of these things that we've just been talking about, it seems President Trump is solely focused on one very particular aspect of the U.S. relationship with China. So where does the trade war fit in here, and also the TPP? I know you talk about that in your book as well.
There is a lot of gratitude throughout Asia to President Trump among governments and civil societies for pushing back against China's domineering ways and for really taking a stand on China's misappropriation of intellectual property and high technology and its general bullying posture in trade relations. I think that for the U.S. to now insist that China's theft of intellectual property has to stop and that it has to open up its markets to American companies without the companies promising to transfer their most sensitive technology in exchange, these are all good and long overdue things. And I congratulate the president and his administration for that stand. But the problem is there's too much bombast and too much of a general indiscriminate and inchoate posture of President Trump around the whole trade issue. The trade deficit in itself, economists insist, is not the core problem. And then, you know, you've got all of the other miserly and short-sighted attitudes surrounding this with respect to the crying need for a new multilateral trading arrangement that would rise to higher standards and integrate the countries of East and Southeast Asia and the Pacific region around a more, I'd say, democracy-centered trading union or trading collaboration. It doesn't rule out eventual Chinese entry, but it certainly imposes very tough conditions on that and generates, I'd say, a badly needed counterweight to the coalition that China is trying to build economically and geopolitically of client states and dependent states that are virtual satellites around its hegemony. That's what the Trans-Pacific Partnership promised, a new collaboration for multilateral freer trade that would be good for economic growth in the U.S. and that would also be a counterweight to China's hegemonic ambitions. And I do still believe that we need to revisit this, that it is increasingly a compelling and urgent national interest of the United States to join, maybe renegotiate around the margins, but ultimately join the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Well, Larry, we will leave it there. I feel like we've only just scratched the surface, but you know, your book and the report that you mentioned from the Hoover Institute are great places for listeners to go if they want to dive deeper into the threats that China poses to democracy and also what folks can do to push back against them. So, Larry Diamond, thank you so much for joining us today on Democracy Works.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
I was struck by our interview, Jenna's interview, in the same way I was struck by the book, that it is brave in that he names names and calls out people, not just politicians, but also, you know, hangers-on who are getting rich at the hands of these authoritarians, but also just how straightforward and no couching in academic ease in terms of how he's framing these, the way he sees it. And I think that's a real contribution to the public debate right now.
And it also reflects an understanding of, for example, what we read in How Democracies Die and other work that we've talked about, which talks about how democracies can sort of become authoritarian mm-hmm. over time. They understand these things.
Of course.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you have Russia, China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, kind of comparing notes, right? Oh, that worked for them. Maybe we should try that too, right? But in any case, I also—
Is that your axis of evil?
It's right up there, man. I can be persuaded to include others, but they're pretty good. But I do think it is, you know, important to kind of go back to this idea that, you know, the United States and many established democracies throughout the world simply are not prepared for the kind of competition, not to say Cold War, that is in the offing.
I'd go another step and say that, you know, the divisiveness we see in the United States right now, which has become significantly worse, I think, over
yes.
the last several years, it just creates more openings for
it. Right, exactly. And they're smart enough to see that and exploit
yeah.
it. And as the United States and other countries retrench and talk about America first, China is all too happy to go into these countries, in, especially in Africa.
Yeah, build their infrastructure.
Build their infrastructure
them.
And then say, oh, and by the way, those precious metals, how about we just sign that onto the agreement? I mean, they are playing, as you say, the long game. And this is appropriate for our culture that's been around for, what, 8,000 years, right? So
right.
They have the resources economically, but also in just in terms of candle power and education. And, you know, it's not that there isn't something distinctively admirable about what they're doing. It's just that if you, they are doing this in a way that is undermining not just democracy here, but undermining human rights.
Yeah, and think of the contrast with the Cold War. I mean, if there was one thing during the Cold War, as I remember, we could at least look at these communist countries and say it's an economic system that simply doesn't work.
Right.
People are miserable under it. It doesn't produce efficiently in any way. But I think China is showing actually that you can have a somewhat effective market-based or market-type economy, but without any of the freedoms that we have come to associate with
economies. I mean, you know this, but in class I've shown people, here's a picture of the Shanghai skyline. I mean, it's incredibly impressive.
And we're used to thinking of a sort of connection between a capitalist economy and freedom.
That was always the argument.
And political freedoms.
Right.
But they're showing the two do not necessarily have to go together.
Well, and that, for most of the third world, again, what they want is to be able to have a middle-class lifestyle, right? They want to be able to have three meals a day and color TV and air conditioning. They don't care about whether or not they can write an op-ed to the newspaper or march in protest. And just in terms of hierarchy and needs, it's a pretty persuasive argument they're making to a lot of people in the third world.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, this is a great book, wasn't
it? Yeah,
it's a terrific
interview.
I really enjoyed reading that.
Yeah, and we all of us who are concerned about democracy owe a debt of gratitude to Larry Diamond for his life's work.
Yeah.
So, my name's Chris Beam.
I'm Michael Berkman.
Thanks for listening. This has been Democracy Works.